History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories right there where you live with the power to amaze you. Stories we're never going to hear if we don't take the time to ask a few questions and listen to what some of the more seasoned members of our communities have to say. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we end up learning so much. We're educated, we're entertained. Often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The man that we have the privilege of hearing from today has been on my list for a long, long time. Ray McClure's wife, Bonnie, first suggested I interview him about 15 years ago when I was showcasing World War II vet stories on television. Ray declined then because he felt there were others more deserving of recognition. Over the years, it's come up a few more times, and Bonnie's powers of persuasion finally prevailed. I had the chance to finally meet Ray at the recent opening of a World War II exhibit at the Reedley Museum in Reedley, California. Not too far from where we recorded this interview at the Reedley Airport, one of countless airports that Ray has gotten to know quite well in a long career in aviation. We're going to hear about his missions as a B-17 pilot in World War II, how the life-saving work of the Tuskegee Airmen made a big impact on his perspective. We'll hear about his exploits as a B-26 pilot during the Korean War as well, but we'll start out before he ever thought about flying a plane, and the small school he attended as a boy outside of Shafter, California.
It was called Rio Bravo, and there's one room for all eight grades. That's how small it was. I went to school there, and then later on, my mother and dad split up. She moved to San Pedro, and my dad got killed in a car wreck, a single-car car wreck, between Shafter and Bakersfield, he and another guy. The other guy wasn't hurt. His name was Clarence Rice. He was driving, and the old man was riding. He got blasted there. So I remember him pretty well, but, you know, not all that much because I wasn't that old. And I went to San Pedro High School down south. That's in the harbor there, Los Angeles. Actually, I graduated from high school when I was 16. And I immediately went to work for California Shipyards. That's the one that, it was a big shipyard. They were building these Victory ships. And I was a ship fitter there because I could read a blueprint, not because I could do such a good job. But anyway, just as I started in there pretty good, that's when the Japanese hit Pearl Harbor. And I took my high school diploma in hand and went racing down to the recruiting station, volunteered. The recruiting guy, he wasn't the brightest star in the sky, but, you know, he accepted it. He accepted the fact that when I told him I was 18, he's okay. And so the next thing I know, I'm on a train to Little Rock, Arkansas, Camp Robinson. They made me a head scout in the rifle team. And let me tell you, I was only there for about 3 or 4 weeks, less than a month. We were on bivouac back in the Ozark Mountains, and I was walking down this little path, swamp on each side, and we'd been back there quite a ways, and on bivouac, you don't have anything, really, you know, no facilities that you don't build and all that, and I'm walking along, and this little puddle-popping two-place airplane came over, and these guys were throwing flower bombs. They were flower bombing us, and one hit me right on the helmet, and out into the swamp I went. And I said to myself, self, that is where I'm going to be, is up there throwing the flower bombs, not down here in the swamp. When we got back to Camp Robinson there at Little Rock, there was a recruiting team there, and they were looking for cannon fodder. I didn't realize it at the time, but their loss rate in the Air Corps, which that was before the Air Force, was 40%, which is awful high. You can figure that there's 10 guys at least in a B-17, And if it went down and they didn't get out, you know, you lost 10 guys at a whack there, and 40% of the airplanes, for instance, you know, 100 goes in and 60 comes out on the raid. That's bad. That's real bad. And anyway, I made that, and they sent me to the University of Buffalo, at Buffalo, New York, to take what's called stanine tests to determine whether you were qualified to be a pilot, navigator, bombardier, or back to the boonies, you know, the bad guys get you. So anyway, I made pilot. I was lucky. We had three deals. You go to primary, that was your first schooling, basic, which was the second, and advanced, which was your third. They sent me to primary, and we were flying steermen, open cockpit steermen. It was quite an experience. Every instructor, they sent us to the civilian fields for primary, but the instructors were military. He was a lieutenant, this guy we had, and he was assigned five cadets. The one thing that really I look back on and have to chuckle that happened to me was I was the first one of the five. They had the Army come in and run a check on how this guy was doing with his cadets. And this guy would ride with you to see how you were doing and if you were passing everything okay. And so I had got through this first initial deal. So our instructor said, well, take one of the airplanes and go out and fly. It's fly around and, you know, play. And so I did. And I got carried away a little bit with all that and was out in the country. And I'm flying around and I suddenly realized that I thought I didn't have enough gas to get back to the field. And I thought, boy, this is going to be a short stint for me. They're going to kick me out, you know, because they're going to frown on me crashing this airplane somewhere. And I'm looking around, and there was this little road, and the only thing on it for miles in either direction was a gas station. So I landed there. I buzzed it first, and a guy came out, so I knew there was someone there. And then I landed on this road and taxied up as close as I could to the station. And I kept the airplane running because it took two or three people to start one little thing. And this guy come out, and his eyeballs are about as big as a pumpkin. So I motioned him over. I kept the airplane just ticking over. I told him, I said, I've only got $5, and I want that much gas. And he says, oh, okay. So he run in the station, and he got some cans. And I don't know how much he put in, but he put in, I told him where to pour it, and he put it in. I waved goodbye, and away I went down the road again and off into the wild blue yonder, you know, thinking, thank you, Lord, and made it back to field fine. And the next thing that happened to me in primary that sort of stands out, this instructor we had, he wanted to be a combat pilot, and here he is instructing, and he isn't just real happy about that. And the way you ride in those things, the instructor was in front, the student in back, and the instructor had a great big round mirror on the trailing edge of the wing, and he'd look at you, you know, he could see you there. And they didn't have radios in those days. They had what was called a Gosport, and it was a funnel. It started out as a funnel on his end, and it's about a half inch tube, rubber tube, and it come back and it plugged into your headset through these little deals on the earphones, you know, and you could hear pretty good with it. And he got to looking at me, you know, and they flipped upside down, and we're driving along upside down, and he says, I think you're sitting a little high in that seat. You better adjust it. And, you know, he'd probably done this 100 times. Well, without thinking, I just pulled the deal, and boy, I shot to the end of that stop out the slipstream, and I thought, I'm going to make my first parachute jump, I think. And but it turned out I didn't. But then I went on the basic. We flew BT-13s, which was a big radial thing, and had a sliding greenhouse that went over the seats, two-place job. And it flew good, and we did pretty good on that, except on my night cross-country, I really, really thought I was going to make my first parachute jump. It was into a three-state deal. We had radios in these airplanes. The meteorologist assured us that there was going to be a beautiful night. No problem, boy. It's just, you know, you're all set. Well, about halfway around, the weather started going bad on me. And I was by myself and, you know, feeling lonesome and talking to God and all this stuff. We went on around, or I did, and I was running low on gas. You know, whenever you start out on something like that, it's all set up on minutes, you know, and you go to the exact minute, you know, if you want to make a turn or the end of the deal, you're supposed to be there if the time says you are. And so I ran into this weather. It was getting pretty murky. I couldn't see too much and everything, and I couldn't see the field. I knew I was in the area, or I thought I was. The time said I was. And I thought, well, I'm going to run out of gas, and I don't want to be down here low if I'm going to leave this bird. So I just decided to start climbing when I saw this great big light and these anti-aircraft lights. I don't know if you've ever seen one or not. They used to have them in front of movies. This before your time, probably, but they used to have them when the war was over. They put them in front of these movies and would wave them back and forth, you know, advertising and everything. Well, I saw this light going, and they had heard me, and they started flashing the light. So, you know, I made it back all right and got in. From there, I went on to multi-engine training.
Well, hold on a second. You said the BT-13 flew pretty good. Everybody else told me that it would vibrate all over the place.
Well, it was called the multi-vibrator, you know, but, you know, I didn't know. It seemed good to me after that steerman. I thought it was a pretty neat airplane, really.
And one more question for you, because, I mean, you told me that it was the flower bomb hitting you that made the light bulb go off. I want to be a pilot. But what about that first time that you were in the cockpit? Because most pilots I know say there was something they felt the first time they were actually up in the air and in control. Did you feel something? Was there something that caught hold of you in that moment?
I don't really remember. At 95, you forget some of those things, you know. But I used to go out to the Long Beach Airport, you know, and scrub airplanes and kick tires and stand fire guard and all that stuff, hoping these guys would give me a ride, you know. And that's where I really got in the air first. But this Piper Cub thing, that was the first Piper Cub I'd been in, and there's an old saying, a Piper Cub is the safest airplane in the world. It will only barely kill you. But anyway, yeah, that I never did feel anything. I really liked it, though. I really liked flying. Have all my life. I used to go months without a day off, just flying, 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 flying. I did a lot of work out the Long Beach Airport just to get a ride. Then I got into the military, and they started teaching me how to fly, and that was pretty neat. When I went to multi-engine, we flew what was called a UC-78, the old bamboo bomber, Seymour, Indiana. But, you know, another deal on that, when I was in basic, it was in Montgomery, Alabama. It was near there. And on the other side of the city was Tuskegee. And, of course, you know, dumb. All of us made fun of those guys because, you know, we'd get on the air and everybody could hear everybody in those days. They didn't have it like now. And we'd go, you know, hello, Tuskegee Tower. This is Army Fo-Fo-Fo, you know, and a bunch of crap like that. And looking back on it, during the war, I regretted that because these guys had, they graduated about the same time I did. They flew a lot of times, we would meet up with our fighter escorts, and it was them. And could those boys fly? And they would stay with you no matter what. They stayed till they were just on fumes, practically, you know, where the other fighter jocks would go home. They would not, boy. They were with you. I would have liked to have had them all the time, but I didn't, unfortunately. But I saw then that I had made a bad mistake. I was only 19, for Pete's sake. That was a kids' war, believe it or not. The kids fought that war, and it was terrible. The oldest guy in my crew was 25, and, you know, there's just one of him. But anyway, I went into this multi-engine stuff, and just before we graduated, about, I would say, probably 2 weeks before we graduated, the CAA, which is now the FAA, came in, and I never did have a pilot's license as such. Never did. The team came in. They wrote us, all of us, all the cadets that was getting ready to graduate, they wrote us out a commercial multi-engine license with an instrument rating. Now, boy, you know, we didn't think much of it at the time, but looking back, that was really something. I got through that all right. And then they sent me to Florida, B-17 transition school. I flew a little anti-submarine patrol a little bit there before I went over to England. and got over there. I got over late, and so it wasn't as bad then. It was bad, but it wasn't like it was at first. Those guys that was over there at first was catching the devil, boy. They, you know, that's where the 40% loss rate was. Yeah. Terrible deal.
Did you get to fly to England, or did you have to go on a ship?
I went on a ship. That shows you what they thought of me. No, they had the airplanes over there already. You know, it was all set. Same thing when I went to Korea. And I could have paddled that devil and made faster time. You know, it was terrible. But anyway, we get over there and we start going. And not too much happened to me in World War II. I just knew I was not going to get hurt or killed. I knew it. Well, that's sort of silly, you know, because next day you get your head blown off. But anyway, a mission consists of early in the morning or whenever they're going to go. The Americans flew day missions and the British flew night. But anyway, on a mission, the flight crews, all of them, all the flight guys, would meet in the ready room. And they would be briefed by the intelligence guys and they would be telling us what to expect and where we were going and all this stuff. How they knew that, I don't know, because those suckers never got in the air. They weren't stupid, you know. But anyway, they would tell us all this stuff. And then the squadron leader would take off, and his second-in-command would take off with him. He took off double ship at a time. And they would circle until all of us got airborne and in formation. Okay, then we'd head out in close formation. A lot of times we picked up other B-17 outfits, you know, we'd all join in together. Because sometimes you had as much as, 40, 50, 60 airplanes going. So we'd be in this tight formation going, and we'd cross the channel and start in. And then our fighter escort would come in and join us. And boy, I always prayed that those red-tailed guys would be there. They flew P-51s. And they had red tails. Then the German fighters would come up. And the German fighters, they didn't give a tinker's damn about our airplanes, our fighters. They wanted us down. They were after the bombers, not the fighters. You know, to them, that was secondary. They could care less. But our boys, it was their job to stop them. They could flat fly, boy, and they would take them on. And they would stay right with you. And then, it was an odd thing, the German fighters would just go home. That meant that the next instant you were going to be in a wall of flak. And, you know, when they left, they didn't want to shoot their own planes down, naturally, so it was going to follow. And the flak and the anti-aircraft guns would start.
And we'll have to pick it up there when we come back. Ray McClure, 95 years old, is our guest today. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
38-33-28. Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with Ray McClure. At age 95, he is still a Gold SEAL certified flight instructor. But in World War II, he was flying B-17s with the 452nd Bomb Group in Europe. He told us how the African-American pilots flying red-tailed P-51 escorts for him earned his utmost respect, those Tuskegee airmen helping to chase off German fighter planes. But when those German fighters left, he knew the flak was about to begin.
When they left, we would all spread out like crazy. I mean, you know, half a mile between airplanes because that flak comes up. We didn't want two or three airplanes going down with one burst of flak, if you can follow that. But that was the reasoning behind that. And those German fighters, by the way, when they would come in, if they were on level with you or before climbing for you, just before they got into you, they would flip over upside down. And the reasoning for that was if they got in trouble, they could, I don't know if you know what a split S is or not, they could split S out fast. I mean, really, you know, you're going straight down right now, whereas if they were right side up, they would either have to punch it over, which would take time, or climb to get out of the deal. And our gunners would get them. Boy, those boys of mine, those kids were really good. And everybody had a gun, you know, when we got into that mess. They were on a gun. The radio operator, they all had assigned guns. And most of them had double 50s. That's why they flipped upside down, so they could split us and get the hell out of there. So anyway, we would keep going and knew, you know, we'd start hitting that flak. And I hated that flak. They didn't ask me, but I would have told them right away, I do not like flak. Because, you know, you see this black poof. That's all you see. But boy, there is shrapnel flying in all directions like crazy. And those flak shells were set to where they would explode at a certain altitude. They, you know, this is what exploded them. Well, we would change altitude ever so often, up and down and around, trying to evade it, but you know, you can't evade all of it. The dangerous part of that mission was at the last part, when you were going for the target, it had to be straight and level for the bombardier to get on the target, because when he toggled his switch, dropped his bombs, everybody dropped their bombs. I mean, we saturated the town. We didn't care whether there was a hospital, a school, whatever. But all those people knew we were coming, and most of them were in a deal where it sheltered them. So, you know, we were hitting empty buildings and stuff. But we were out to win a war, not win a popularity contest. We were out to win a war, and so we tried to win it, and we did. But that was good. But on one deal, the only thing that really happened to me, besides a few bullet holes in the skin of the B-17, was on the way home, the number three engine, they went from left to right, one, two, three, and four. And the number three engine caught on fire. I don't know how or why or anything. I think maybe they might have tagged an oil tank or something in it. And each engine had its own fire retardant. Well, the co-pilot boy and I, we tried to put that fire out, and we tried, and we tried, and, you know, I even thought about asking for volunteers to walk out there with the fire extinguisher, but I didn't think I'd get any volunteers. But anyway, we're, you know, the thing bad about an engine fire is behind that engine is the wing spar, and that's what holds the wing on, and, you know, keeps it stiff and, you know, real neat. And anyway, it kept on and on, and we ran out of fire retardant, and we were still way out over the water. And I told the crew, I says, well, you know, you guys can start bailing out if you want. I'll notify the boat boys to come out and pick you up, because we dropped out of formation. So, you know, everybody knew we were in trouble because we didn't want to hold them up, and we were a lot slower than they were. And so they asked me what I was going to do, and I said, well, I'm not going to jump out of a perfectly good airplane with three engines running. I said, but you can rest assured if that wing starts to look like it's going to buckle or something, because, you know, I figured that a lot of times the spar got hot and, you know, would start coming apart. And getting out of a B-17 that's out of control was just almost impossible. It was really bad. And so they says, no, we'll ride in with you. So, you know, to make a long story short, we made it. We got it home all right. And I don't think they ever used that airplane again, though. I think it, we did enough damage or had enough damage that they did it. But then that was really, other than just, you know, getting holes in the airplane, that was about it for World War II.
Let's talk about that. Why don't you tell everybody how many men are on your plane? How many men are in your crew?
Usually there was 10 men in the crew. The tail gun had double 50s, belly gun had double 50s, and the upper turret had double 50s, and there was double 50s out the nose. The waist guns each had a gun apiece because they had a lot of action going there. They were moving a lot, you know, trying to trace these guys. They were pretty good, but the one guy that really, really, I used to shudder about it, our belly turret. This is a turret that hangs down quite a ways below the airplane's belly because the guy had to have a shot at the fighters coming in and everything. So it hung down along. Well, if you caught some bullets in there, you got that turret to where it wasn't moving or anything, and you had the belly of an airplane in, that turret gun on the belly turret gun was going to get ground to meat. You know, he was just, he was a dead man, that's all. You just, oh, they never seemed to think about that. I thought about it a lot, but didn't seem to bother them at all.
Well, that's what I was getting at. Yeah, I've talked to guys who they had that gear shot up and they couldn't retract the turret up in there, and some tense moments. But I'm thinking tense moments for you, because these aren't strangers to you. You've gotten to know this crew a little bit, right?
Yes, it is. You know, these guys were part of your family practically, you know. And so if one of them got hurt or something, I never did get any of them hurt or killed, thank heavens. It would have really, really made me feel bad, real bad.
Well, and that mission you were describing. So you've been hit, your engine's on fire. Oh. Everything you try, you can't put the fire out. And you're coming back over the English Channel not knowing if you're going to make it or not. So how much of a burden do you carry in those moments for those other guys on your plane?
Well, I ordered them to jump, you know, when we first started in, and I realized how bad this situation is, but they wouldn't. So I felt pretty good about that they would, you know, choose to go in with me.
I guess they must have had a lot of confidence in you as a pilot.
Oh, I don't know about that, but every one of them, every chance I got, I would put a different crew member on the controls in case something happened to me. Someone else could bring the bird in, you know. Everybody didn't have to die if just because I was. So I would try to get every one of them as much stick time as I could in the cockpit, and that's a lot of them could do pretty good. That was something. They were all kids, and you know, it's like they are now playing these video games, you know. They're good at video games, and these guys were good at that, too. You know, you tell them something, and you tell them all was going to be well, and they believed you. It was not like that, you know.
And so what was that landing like when you brought it in with that engine fire?
Well, we had it feathered, of course. It wasn't bad at all. The gear came down, which, thank heavens, it came down. And then from then on, it's just a piece of cake. It's just routine. You just come in and land it, you know. And it was a good flying bird. I really liked that airplane. That was a really neat airplane. You could just blow it to pieces and it'd still fly. I just saw some guys, one outfit had his control panel shot out. You know, nothing was working there. You know, he didn't know how much gas he had. He didn't know what RPM he had. He didn't know what direction he was going. And he was going the wrong direction, shot to ribbons. He was just shot to pieces all by himself. He crossed over this German airfield, and they sent a German fighter up after him. He says, go shoot that sucker down. So, you know, finish shooting him down. And so this German guy came up, and he saw what it was. I heard about this later. We didn't hear about it for a long time. Pulled up beside him, and by motioning and everything, he got across to him that they were going the wrong way. So he got them turned around, headed the right way, and he escorted them to the middle of the English Channel. Escorted them. And, you know, and they said when he left, he gave them a big salute and left. And then later on, I read a deal, an article somewhere, this German fighter jockey. They didn't want to say anything about it because the Germans would have killed him. They would have shot him for doing that, you know. He lived over here, and they lived only 50 miles apart. You know, the pilot of that B-17 and that German fighter, and they got together. It was astounding. You know, I couldn't hardly believe that. Got to be real good friends, I guess. But they said that this guy came up and he just kept after them until he got across to them that they were going the wrong way. And he got them turned around. And, of course, he didn't go back across his airfield. They'd have sent up a German fighter to shoot him down.
How many missions did you fly over there?
21. It wasn't all that big a deal for me. But the one that I hate to say it, but I really had fun in Korea. That was something else. I stayed in the reserve. I did an awful lot of civilian flying. That's what I was doing all the time, was civilian flying. I lived my whole life, seemed like, in a cockpit, my adult life. When I got out of World War II, the officers had the option of what they called an early out. You know, the war was over and everything, and they had officers running out their ears, and they wanted to get rid of us. So I'd been flying four-engine bombers hundreds of hours. I thought, well, I'll take an early out and go fly for the airlines. They'll want me. You know, boy, here I am, hotshot Charlie. Come home, go roaring down to all the airlines, all the major airlines I went to. They all told me exactly the same thing. They said, what college did you graduate from? And I said, college? I didn't go to college. You know, I went to war. And they said, well, we want college people. And so they, you know, I was out. My next job was a busboy. So I was a busboy for about 4 or 5 days, I guess. And I finally got my head squared away. And I went back out to the Long Beach airport. And I went to the biggest fixed-based operator on the airport. Randall Scott, Scott Aero. I told him, I said, I'm just out of the service. I need a job. And he says, well, do you have an instructor's license? I said, well, no. But he says, if you had an instructor's license, I'd put you to work in the morning. You could go to work. And I says, oh, okay. So with that, I went roaring over to the FAA. By this time, it was the FAA. And in those days, you could take the test right there. They'd grade it. And, you know, he either passed or didn't pass. So I went roaring over there. I got a hold of this old inspector who's dead now. Everybody I know is dead now. He sat me down, and I took this instructor's test, written test, and I passed it. So he set me up for a flight the next morning to see if I could fly, you know. I passed that all right. He wrote me out my license right there, the instructor's license, you know. And so then I go over with Scott Aero and saw old Randall Scott again and waving my new temporary instructor's license. And he says, can you come in the morning? I says, boy, I'll be here bright and early. Just what time? And he says, well, I've got 9 students for you. I said, really? He says, yeah. So that was really the start of my civilian flying career was that, because I had 9 students from in all. I had hundreds of students.
I was going to say, how many students you think you've had since then, over all the years combined?
No, I had hundreds of them. My daughter got her license on her 16th birthday. In fact, we flew her home from the hospital when she was only 3 days old. And my wife got hers on her 21st, got her pilot's license. But I have literally taught hundreds of people to fly.
And who knows, you might be the next. It's break time again, but there's more to come with 95-year-old Ray McClure. Don't forget to check out the photos and video of Ray at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. 95-year-old Ray McClure loves the cowboy life in Wonder Valley, east of Fresno in Central California. But so much of his life has been spent in the air, more than 25,000 hours in more than 60 different aircraft. We've heard about his time in B-17s in World War II. Let's find out how he came to fly the B-26 during the Korean War.
When that came along, I went down and volunteered again. I didn't learn my lesson the first time. So I knew this old colonel that was over the thing out of the field. He was on regular military. And I says, hey, can you get me back in active duty? And he says, sure. I said, well, I'd like to go to Korea. And he says, you're kidding me. And I said, no, you know, why not? And I'll be a son of a gun. 4 days later, I think it was, I get this telegram. 2 days before that, they had brought me back into the service. I was in the service then, and I didn't know it. You know, that's how quick it was. I said, well, what the heck? They'll spend, you know, 2 or 3 months training me, you know, and all this stuff, and ship me over. And then I'll spend, you know, 4, 5, 6 months flying, and then they'll early out me over there and send me home. Wrong. They sent me right over. Boy, the door didn't hit me in the fanny at all leaving. I'll tell you, they sent me right over, and then I get over to Iwakuni, Japan. That's where we were operating out of, and it was a Australian base, actually, and we were transiting there. You know, they were letting us go, and those Australians get mad at you, and they'd turn the heat on in the summer and, you know, turn it off in the winter. But anyway, we flew out of there. I was in a low-level night attack outfit. Flew the B-26 Invader. You'd go in, just the pilot and the navigator, and hit what they call targets of opportunity, low-level night attack. These guys that had been over there quite a while, you know, and all this, they were telling me, says, ah, he says, they don't know how to shoot, really. No one's ever taken them hunting. They don't lead you. They shoot straight at you, and by the time the bullet gets there, you're gone. I said, oh, boy, that sounds outstanding. We'd fly across out of Iwakuni, Japan, which was right next door to Hiroshima where the big A-bomb hit. And it was still in shambles when I was there. I'm older than dirt, by the way. So anyway, we'd go on in and across Korea. At the middle of the state, they have what they call the bomb line. Anything south of that was friendly. Anything north of that was bad guys. Just the pilot and the navigator was all went in the airplane.
So this is a lot different from what you'd been doing in World War II.
Yes, indeed. It was a lot different. Before, there's an old saying, yea, though I fly through the valley of death, I shall fear no evil, because I'm at 80,000 feet and still climbing, you know. So, but yeah, it was a lot different, because you never really got up in the air. You stayed right on the deck, you know, and mm-hmm. You hit these targets of opportunity. By that, they meant the troops up there at night, they would have a lot of little campfires cooking their meals and all this stuff. And then they had, we could hit any train that was there. And convoys, they were sort of hard to see, really, because they had blackout lights, which was a little slot is all it was. We could hit those, but they had 3 hydroelectric plants up there that was off limits. Now, that's a bunch of crap, you know, these politicians running a war. It was really bad. We could have blacked out that whole area in one night, but they wouldn't let us hit it and just hit anything you could. Well, the first mission that I went on a couple with the old-timers to get the feel of things and see what was going on, you know. And so my first mission on my own, we get up into the area where targets of opportunity were, and I saw these 4 little trucks, 2 on each side of the road, burning. They were blazing away, and I thought, well, the guy here before me, you know, set them on, and I'll add to it a little bit and see what happens. So I was down, it was a moonlit night. You could see like crazy, and I was about 150, 200 feet in the air way down this road, and I'm coming through, and I didn't notice at the time, but there was a little hill on each side of those trucks. 2 hills on each side of the road. So I come down through thunder, and about a mile or so out, I thought, Well, I'll see how my guns are working. I squeezed off first and quit. And in your ammunition, you have armor-piercing incendiaries. They're like a tracer. That airplane had 14 50 calibers firing forward. Now, that's a lot of guns. They had 8 rockets, a tank of napalm under each wing, and 8 250-pound frag bombs. We were just a flying disaster area, that's what we were, you know. And so I squeeze off a burst. They're flashing out there, you can see them, and they were sort of hitting on this hill a little bit. And I should have realized then, I got smart awful fast. And they sparkle when they hit the ground, those armor-piercing incendiaries do, even though they're flaming out, you know, going out. And they were sparking. I started to tell the navigator that, ha, look at that. And I'd quit firing, but the sparkling was still going on. And we were looking right down the barrels of a whole bunch of troops on each hill. We were looking right down their rifle barrels. They were firing like crazy. And my navigator, he realized the same day, time I did, he was screaming, pull up, pull up, pull up. Well, you don't pull up because that slows you down, you know. Boy, I bent those throttles over and we had injection engines, and I had that kicked on, and we went through there probably at about 400 miles an hour. We were really smoking, and boy, it sounded like hail on a tin roof, you know, because they were hitting us, and we got past them. I slowed the airplane down, and it seemed to be flying all right, everything okay, and I thought, boy, those guys were bloody unfriendly. I'm going to go back and speak to them. So I got that airplane turned around and still about 150 foot in the air and slowed down. And I'm coming back and I got them zeroed. I know exactly where they were because of those trucks. And I laid on those guns. And those 1450s were just screaming. You know, I really had them smoking. And I was spraying lead like crazy coming in on this one hill. And I kicked off a couple of rockets to, you know, let them know that we were there. And as I went over, I dropped a tank of napalm and two 250-pound frag bombs. I says, you know, you guys want to play bad guys and, you know, all this? I'll show you what a bad guy is. And I got down the road a little ways and turned around and come back and took out the second hill the same way. When I got back to the base, my crew chief looked the airplane over and he said, there's over 400 holes in this airplane. I said, and they didn't hit a thing, especially us, you know. Yeah. But we had armor plating on the bottom, too, that helped. But I really tore those guys crazy. And from then on, it was the same way. We just hit targets of opportunity. Just every night we'd hit them. We'd land down there in friendly territory, rearm and refuel, and go back up and hit them again, and then go home, and then we were off for a day or so. But I was going there one night, we'd hit the bomb line, and I'd turned off all the lights, and all of a sudden the lights all come on in the cockpit. I thought, what's this? And I look over, and the navigator had his in-flight lunch out, and he was getting ready to have a sandwich and a cup of coffee. What he was getting ready to have was my foot up his fanny. But, boy, I shut that off in a hurry. You know, they really couldn't see us all that good, I don't think.
That's why you shut that off in a hurry. You didn't want them to see you, right?
Yeah, right. It was something. But I pulled one little stretch up there. I was only there for about 2 weeks and volunteer again. And they needed a pilot to go in with a radio jeep and a radio operator to be with the ground troops to call in an airstrike because they figured that the pilot knew how to get the guy in there. And that wasn't too neat a deal. The Chinese jumped off and came south, and this guy I was with in this mud hole that he called a foxhole, he says, don't worry about it. We'll just hunker down. And he says, they'll just keep running and screaming. He said, then we raise up and shoot them. Oh, okay, so that's what happened. They all ran by, and they got themselves shot. But they, those ground pounders, man, they live bad, I'll tell you. And it seems like there's, everywhere you go on the ground, there was mud. Mud, mud, mud.
Did that experience give you a new level of respect for those guys who were fighting on the ground, who you'd been supporting the whole time but hadn't walked in their shoes until then?
No, I knew, you know, about that stuff, because it seems like in combat, it's always either mud or snow. Bad. And I knew that, you know, seeing these guys. And I always, always had respect for those guys. I'm telling you, it was something else. I'm certainly glad I got out of it when I did, you know, and didn't have to go over there and join them. While I was in Korea, too, the guy that was the CO of the Air Police, he upended his Jeep in a rice paddy. Not a good place to go. Because I don't know if you know how they fertilize a rice paddy. Wow. Anyway, he got hurt pretty bad, and they sent him home. And I caught the brownie button. They put me over the deal because in my wild career, I was a motorcycle cop at one time. And I spent 14 years riding a motorcycle at night and flying during the day. Well, there's three things I wanted to be when I was a kid. First one was a pilot. Next one was a motorcycle cop, believe it or not. And the next one was a cowboy. And I made them all three. I loved riding that motorcycle. I hated writing tickets. Loved the motorcycle. You know, they go together. Either you write the tickets or they kick your fanny off, you know. Yeah. So I wrote a few tickets now and then, enough to stay on. So because of that police experience, they stuffed me on as CO of this air police deal when this guy went home. And over there, it seemed like, I don't understand why they do it, but because a lot of our guys are involved in it too, but they had what they call shoe packs. And over in Korea, you know, it's mud and snow fanny deep to a giraffe. And my boys were having problems. They couldn't get shoe packs because the ones they'd sent over for us had got sidetracked by some guy that had put them on the black market, sold them on the black market. And so I knew this. Then I found out that one of the merchants there in this little town had a whole bunch of shoe packs for sale. Well, I took about 11 or 12 of my big air police boys, and we went and paid that sucker a visit and took all of his shoe packs. When I got back, I went back to flying like I was before, and I'd taken a leave of absence from the police department, so I went back to riding motorcycles at night and flying during the day.
So you continued to fly for all these years, and I'm sure you've had a close call or two over those years. Any that you reflect on occasionally?
Yeah, the worst one I had broke my back, and they tried to get my right leg off. The doctor over in Catalina Island, they didn't have a hospital, just a resident doctor, you know, had his office there. I took the first flight out of the morning over to Catalina and back. The water was just like, this floor is nice and flat, and I had some paperwork to do, and we had a brand new pilot named Jim Andrews. Oh, in the meantime, we'd taken the right seat controls out because people were prone to grab them, you know, and that's bad news sometimes. Anyway, I sent this Jim Andrews over while I did this paperwork, and then we came back, and then we went over on a 10 o'clock flight, and I thought, well, I'll just ride along, see how he's doing, because we just hired him. He'd been flying what they call an albatross, a great big amphibian airplane that the military used a lot. And you move the yoke a foot, count to 10, and the old bird moves. You know, it really didn't respond real well. And a goose, you just rolled your eyeballs and that thing moved. That was my favorite airplane, was that Grumman Goose. Oh, what a plane. But anyway, I'm riding in the right seat. We go over and land. No, everything's fine. And taxi up on this ramp we had, load up our passengers, come out. I didn't know it, but about 4 or 5 days before that, he had dragged a float landing in Long Beach, and he was afraid of the airplane. And so we start out, and we start what is called a porpoise, which means you're bouncing, and then you're down and up, hit the water and go back up and down and up. And the only way out of a porpoise is full throttle and suck that stick back into your chest and wrap your arms around it and hold on, and that'll get you out of it. Well, I didn't have any controls on my side, and so we're starting to porpoise, and there was no doorway between the passengers and us. And you don't give a captain of an airline duel, you know, with all the passengers there. Or the next week, you won't have any passengers. We're bouncing and bouncing, and he's chasing that deal, and he was behind it all the way. And when he should have been pulling back, he was pushing forward. And the last thing I saw him do, we took a bounce, the last bounce, and we went about 200 or so feet in the air, maybe three. And the last thing I saw him do, he straight-armed that stick and locked his elbows, and we went straight in. Boom. And I thought, oh, my goodness, this is going to hurt. And maybe if I just relax and let it shove me around, everything will be okay. So, boy, did we hit. Ooh-wee. And what it did, I found out later, saw the airplane later. There was a bulkhead behind the pilot and co-pilot seat, and then the passengers deal. Well, it wiped off the nose of that airplane from that bulkhead forward. It was gone. I was underwater, and it seemed like I was underwater for forever, and I never remember gasping for air or anything. What happened was the door in and out of the airplane's in the back, and all the passengers were scrambling out the back, getting out of the airplane and into the water and get to shore. And we had flotation cushions on the back of the seats, and they left them. They didn't pull out a single one. And so that pried the nose up, and I came up with it, got some air, and got myself kicked loose with my good foot. My right foot was all tangled up in this mess of wreckage. I was on the side of the airplane away from shore, and no one realized that I was still out there. And I went back to the door, paddled back to that, and reached in, got a flotation cushion, and I was laying on this flotation cushion, and one of our baggage boys on his day off that lived on the island, he was in his swimsuit, and he'd been out there, and we'd been talking, and he realized I wasn't there, and he dove in the water and came out. He swam around the airplane and, you know, got me. This young couple had rented a outboard motorboat, little bitty thing. He called them over. It had freeboard about so much, you know, from the waterline to the side of the boat. And he kept trying to boost me up over that. We called him Rabbit. I says, "Oh, Rabbit, I'll never make it." And he thought I meant I was dying. He starts to cry. And he's bawling. I says, "Would you shut your mouth? You know, get me in the shore, for Pete's sake, you know." And he said later, he says, "You shouldn't have talked to me like that." He says, "You look like the beast from the Black Lagoon." But what did it? Split my scalp from ear to ear, and my skull was showing. I didn't know that. My upper lip was shredded. My nose was pried loose, and various and sundry things. Broke my back, and my right foot, you know, like I said, the old doc over there, he acted like he was going to take it all the way off, you know. And I told him, "No, no, no, you're not." And there happened to be a Navy helicopter there on the island. So when he got through sewing me up and getting me about halfway together, the old doctor, he was a good old guy. He was real religious, and I knew I was in big trouble because he handed me this cup, and I thought it was a cup of coffee or tea or something, you know. And I took a big gulp of that and about choked to death. It was bourbon, straight bourbon. I thought, boy, I'm in worse shape than I thought, because, you know, if I have him do that. But anyway, those guys, I was kept passing out and coming to, and passing out and coming to. And I don't remember getting into the helicopter and putting me in that. Don't remember the flight over to Long Beach. So the next thing, when I woke up, I was in this ambulance looking out the window at the emergency deal. It was parked. It was there and everything. And here stands my wife, my new wife. And I thought, wow. She sort of looked in there casually and turned around and started to walk. And I said, boy, good for her. She's taking this all right. Well, what had happened? She didn't recognize me. I had all these bandages. The only thing sticking out was my eyes and my nose. She hadn't recognized me, but, oh, that was something. But that was the worst wreck I was in. That happened in April, middle of April. And by June, I was back flying again. I had some dandies. Every airplane that I got a chance to, I would fly it.
Is it true that you say, if I can start it, I can fly it?
That's right. Yeah, that's what I told them. If I can start that sucker, I can fly it. Oddly enough, the only airplanes that I ever really got checked out in before I flew it was the military stuff.
I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us some of these stories we couldn't hear anywhere else. When you think way back to those guys that you served with in the old Army Air Corps, how should those guys be remembered? How do you want to be remembered when it's all said and done?
I'd like to be remembered as living to be 130, you know. I think that'd be nice, but I doubt that will happen, but who knows, you know. I'm going to give it a try. But I've got no regrets or anything. All I did was enjoy life. I went through things that you can't believe and just loved every minute of it. I really loved the life I led. And most guys, I'll bet you there isn't 95% have ever been through what I've done and enjoyed. I mean, you know, I'm not saying I did it for any reason at all. I did it because I enjoyed it. I really did enjoy it. And I'd do every minute over again, especially meeting her. she's the one that's kept me on the straight and level. You know, before I met her, I was pretty wild, but I got settled down real fast. 60 years, and enjoyed every minute, every second of it.
And speaking of, we're about out of minutes and seconds on Hometown Heroes today, but there are a few more of Ray's stories included in the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com, where you can also see what Ray looked like then and what he looks like now at 95. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.